This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a real privilege and blessing to be here. I'm very excited to work with Dr. Sachs. A friend told me the same the other day, and it really applies. He said, "You're like a brother from another mother." And, you know, working with Dr. Sachs these last few weeks, we've been getting on Zoom calls and sort of relating to each other on many levels. So it's been fun. As Dr. Sachs alluded to, a lot of chronic disease, in fact, 80 to 90% is largely preventable. And yet, we still have chronic disease rampant in our society, in our nation, in our world. So clearly there is a gap. And I'm now in my 10th year as medical director of the McDougal program. We run, ever since COVID, we run online programs that are 12 days in length for people from around the world to translate knowledge like Dr. Sachs just presented into meaningful action. And I use the word translating knowledge into transformation because transformation to me implies something that's longer term. It's not just a short-term result that then people relapse. It's deeper than that. But here's the issue is that in my 10th year now, this is what I've come to appreciate as the challenge of behavioral change. Anyone know who this is? Sisyphus, right? In Greek mythology, Sisyphus, for his arrogance and his crimes, he was damned by the gods to an eternal fate of rolling this large boulder up a hill, up a mountain. Just when he thinks he's reaching success and has finally made some headway, down the boulder rolls, and he's starting back at ground zero and has a sense of futility. And so I've had a lot of patients who have had these great epiphanies, these great breakthroughs. Yes, I want to do it. Yes, I'm going to start exercising. Yes, I'm going to change the way I'm eating. And they make some initial positive changes, but then, like Sisyphus, they have this experience of the boulder rolling back down the hill. And they feel like, sometimes they don't even feel like they're starting from ground zero. They feel like they've gone even further back. They're higher than the weight that they first started at when they made the dietary effort. And it's really gotten me fascinated about behavioral change. Now, many of you have areas that are not difficult to change, that you do sort of autopilot without thinking, that may be difficult for others. And this is the case for me. Movement is not difficult for me. This is a snapshot of my Fitbit that my brother recently purchased. Jonathan, he's here in the audience, he got for me. And this shows my activity. It's 1 week old. This is my activity from last week. So 44 miles, 89,000 steps. My sleep could use some work. And 446 zone minutes. The picture on the left is a picture of me from 3 weeks ago. 3 to 4 weeks ago, there was a 6 mile trail run race. And the day before, I thought, oh, that sounds really fun. I've been getting into trail running. Let's go ahead and sign up. So you tell me to go run 6, 10, 12 miles, I'm there. It's autopilot. It's sort of built into my routine, my schedule. It comes easy. Similarly, a whole food plant-based diet, this is the crux of the McDougal diet and what we have been addressing chronic illnesses like heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and obesity for decades. In fact, today is the last day of a 12-day program that we're currently running. So after today's talk, I'm actually going to be getting on Zoom with 40 participants from all around the world, mostly US, but we have a few from UK. We have someone from Argentina. And they have had just miraculous results, even just over these 12 days, eating a whole food plant-based diet, just like Dr. Sachs described. This is routine for me. Going to a grocery store and buying my items to last me through the week, cooking up huge pots of bean soup, making large salads for lunch. This is an example of how to eat out when you're eating a whole food plant-based diet. I order oftentimes we'll order a plate of steamed greens or a baked potato. But here's the thing. On the outside, people will look at me and say, oh, so behavioral change looks easy for you. You're eating well, you're at a healthy weight, you're super active. But what really intrigues me is this definition of health that I find so aspirational. And it's from the World Health Organization Constitution. And it says, health is a state of complete, and I underline that word complete, complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Because so often people can come into any sort of intervention program and be focused on, oh, I want to get on fewer medications, or I want to get down to this target weight. And they're focused on concrete little things like that, and they're missing the big picture of this invitation to health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. And so when I look at health in that aspirational sense, then I think of all aspects of my life, everything that I can think of. And there are more. These are just a few that, you know, I see in my own life and I see in the lives of my patients. So certainly nutrition and how we eat, physical activity, and are we moving our body on a daily basis? And as Dr. Sachs said, are we incorporating resistance training? Are we incorporating cardiovascular? Are we making sure that we're flexible? Stress reduction is a huge one, because I think that in our very busy, tech-saturated world, it is so easy for us to get distracted and to be out of the present. We're in the past, we're in the future, we're everywhere but the present. And so stress reduction and having healthy coping skills is a major lifestyle intervention that is worthwhile. In fact, one of the lectures I give at the McDougal program is on emotional eating, because it is absolutely one of our patients' most common ways of coping with stress and adversity in their life. The influence of our environment and our surroundings, right? Whether it's clutter, whether it's inviting, whether it's conducive to you getting good work done, meaningful connection with friends and family. One of the challenges in our distracted culture is that lack of connection. We saw this especially come out, of course, during COVID. A sense of purpose and meaning. Dr. Sachs referred to the blue zones. One of the core pillars of the blue zones, these areas around the world that have a high percentage of people living past the age of 100, was this concept of ikigai in Japanese, or why I get up in the morning, my sense of purpose and meaning. And what Dan Buettner, the journalist and writer of the book, The Blue Zones, found is that those centenarians shared one critical thing in common, is they all had a deep sense of purpose. Spirituality, out of the 263 centenarians that Dan Buettner interviewed, 259 of them had some sense of something outside of themselves. And I know for me, I'm Christian, that's my spiritual background. I know for me that is absolutely central in my own life. Avoidance of unhealthy behaviors, the obvious ones that people think of are smoking, alcohol, drug use. But I get people to think beyond that. I tell them to think about what's their relationship with their phone like, social media. What's their relationship with work like? Again, Dr. Sachs mentioned this rhythm of work and rest, right? In Christian tradition, we have this notion of work and Sabbath, right? And oftentimes we're out of that rhythm. So you can take any good thing, and if the relationship becomes distorted, that can become an unhealthy behavior. And then last, sleep, and just that importance of restoration. There's so many studies on the importance of sleep to our physical health, our metabolic health. And so I invite patients at the start of the program to look at health much more than just their weight and much more than just being off medications. And when I look at my own life this way, then yes, I may be eating healthy and I may be exercising, but there are my Sisyphean struggles. This is one of my Sisyphean struggles. I took this picture yesterday. This is just to the left of where I spend all my time. It's at home in my study. This is my nerve center for seeing patients on Zoom. My whole practice is virtual right now. And I just put it all to the side. And you can't really appreciate, but there's a box under the desk. That's because I can't stack anymore on the table next to me. And then what you also don't see is if I look diagonally to my right in my study, there's more boxes. I wish I could tell you that this is just due to some stressful period I'm in, but this has been my life. I have so many project organization efforts, it is mind-boggling. And that's not the only one. This was taken at 12:05 p.m. today, just over an hour ago. It was like deja vu. See, I had the honor of speaking at last year's talk as well for UCSD Stein. And I was working on slides in the car on the way to the lecture I was giving. And I made a resolution, like, let me not repeat that experience. Let me learn from it. And yet here I am at 12:05 with my parents driving us over here. So I relate to Sisyphus, and the quote that really captures it for me is from the Bible. As I mentioned, I'm Christian, and this quote, let me set the context, is from Paul, who is one of the most important figures in Christianity. He's arguably written 13 books of the Bible. And this comes from the mouth of Paul. "For I do not understand my own actions. For I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord." Romans 7, 15, 24, and 25. This is the predicament. And so I empathize and I relate on a deep level with my patients, with my fellow human being. And I've come to realize that it is just the predicament of humanity, that everyone I know, they may not show it on the outside, but there is something that they struggle with. In fact, they may not even be aware of it, but there is something. So what do we do with that? Well, I have over the years presented at a talk on behavioral change. And there was just one time when I did a back of the napkin type of drawing of a simple framework for behavioral change that has really just continued to endure. And so every program for the last 5-6 years, I've shared this, and that's what I wanted to share with you today. And it was really based on timeless principles. There's not going to be anything new here, but I think people have just appreciated the simplicity of it and the applicability of it. So it's 4 steps, okay? And the very first step is moving from this place of lack of awareness to awareness. This is arguably the most important step of the entire behavioral change framework. If you think, many of you have heard of 12 steps, right? Alcoholics Anonymous. What's the very first step? Admit that you have a problem. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Just think for a moment about the power of that statement. My most difficult patients are the ones who do not see that the problem is theirs. The problem's out there. The problem's my spouse. The problem's my kids who want to eat this. The problem's my work. They're looking everywhere but here. And so awareness is just an absolute quintessential step that without which you will not, in my mind, be able to make progress in a long-term, sustainable, meaningful way. You can't fix what you don't know is broken. The beauty of this is that it's not difficult to improve. It is a skill, it is a muscle that you build, but it begins simply by observation. I have patients literally just observe the course of their day and notice those times that they feel tight, those times that they feel constricted, those times that they feel tension, and notice what's going on. And without fail, over a couple of days of just honest noticing and observing, and I usually share my own struggles because that helps them feel like more comfortable. So saying, yeah, here's what I'm grappling with. And then starting to observe the impact of these patterns of behavior, these habits that they've done blindly or unconsciously for so long. Sometimes it helps with awareness to look back and identify what the triggers are, right? What was the antecedent event leading up to them feeling sad or stressed out? The beauty of awareness is that it improves intentionality. So even without committing to do anything about it, simply by noticing, as Viktor Frankl says, between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space is your power to choose. So simply by observing, sometimes it helps people to create that space and gives them a greater sense of empowerment and an ability to make a rational choice that is based on their values and priorities. And the thing I emphasize here is that with awareness, it's not a destination. It's not like you're aware, you're not aware, you're aware, you're not aware. It's a journey. I've come to appreciate that it's like an onion, and I have committed my life to just continuing to grow in awareness. Every day I'm seeing things that I wasn't aware of before that I'm now becoming increasingly aware of. And a huge teacher for that, by the way, is nature. You go out in nature and instead of just kind of being distracted in your thoughts, you start to notice things. You'll see things that you haven't seen before. Yesterday I saw a falcon. I've seen more falcons and hawks in the last year, and I don't think they're increasing in prevalence in my area. It's that now I'm pausing. If I hear a flutter of a wing or I hear a bird call, I stop and I pause and I just look, instead of just walking by, and I'm seeing more. So that's the first step, awareness. So a good exercise for you just to think about, we don't have time to spend a lot of time with this, but I would encourage you, if you look at this wheel of health, is there one aspect of your health today that you are currently most interested in improving? That is an aspect of awareness. Because people come into our program thinking, oh, I've got to get off this medication, or oh, I've got to change the way I eat. They leave realizing, huh, I need to work on my work situation, or I need to deal with certain stressful circumstances within the home that I haven't been thinking about, and I haven't even been connecting with the way that I've been eating. So think about it for a moment, and just to yourself, imagine if there's one aspect of your health that you are currently most interested in improving. As you grow in your awareness of the various aspects of your health and maybe those areas that are causing you the most consternation or the most stress, usually one or two rises up to that level where, okay, this is what I want to be working on. This is the one that I want to do something about. And so the word I use to capture that is intention, right? It's not quite in the realm of taking action yet, but it's bubbling to the surface. It is that factor that bridges the gap between a desire to do something and actually taking action. And here, specificity is really helpful. There's a big difference I've found between patients who say, I want to start exercising more, versus those who actually put some specifics behind it, such as, I commit for the next 3 weeks to exercise for a minimum of 20 minutes a day. There's a saying that some attribute to Einstein. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different outcome. And yet that's oftentimes what we do, right? We engage in the same thing and again and again without thinking. So I do encourage people, when it comes to intention, to incorporate past lessons. They've most likely had many attempts at dietary change, many attempts at incorporating physical movement that have failed. The only problem is that they haven't necessarily incorporated the lessons from those failed attempts. And so they just try and repeat the same thing. And it's like insanity. And then the last thing with intention is it's so important to connect with your why. Because what I've realized is in the moments of temptation, whether it's attempting food or whether it's sitting on the couch when you know you want to be exercising, the bottom line is that we are of two minds. There's the short-term gratification that wants what it wants and it wants it now. And then there's this longer term of, wow, what would be better for me? And so the more that people can be deeply connected to their values and priorities that they're after, their why, forgiving, because you will, this is why I tell patients, you will lose something in this process. There's something that has you continue to eat unhealthy foods, or there's something that has you continue to sit on the couch when you know you want to be exercising, or there's something that has me having my study in a state of disorganization when I know I would be happier. So I need to count the costs. I need to be very aware of what it is that has me continuing to do that, and then connect with my deeper why. Because that deeper why is what can help guide your behavior in that moment of decision, to a healthier level. And so if we took this exercise one step further, if you could identify a single baby step, and notice I use the word baby step, right? Because a lot of times in our impatience, we want the outcome and we want it now, right? But I try to help patients to have more realistic goals and take one tangible step that they can build momentum off of. So if you could identify a single baby step you could make in this area, either starting a new routine or breaking an old one, what would it be? Step three, remember, four steps, is taking action. Because a lot of us stay in the land of good intentions and never getting, as Dr. Sachs said, right, tomorrow. We'll start eating healthier, we'll start exercising, we'll start sleeping better tomorrow. And then tomorrow becomes tomorrow again. And we just keep pushing it off. And so I like this phrase, getting on things on the court, right? Getting it on the court versus being in the stands as a spectator, just watching things and thinking about things and criticizing and judging. It's much different than getting on the court and playing the game. With the beauty of action is this concept of neuroplasticity. Donald Hebb, a Canadian neuropsychologist in 1949, is famous for this phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. Right? Neurons that fire together, wire together. That can both work against you and for you. Right? Because that means, what that means is that old habits of ours that may not be our healthiest, those neural networks are really well formed, right? Those neurons have been firing together for a long time. Stressed out, eat something really sweet or salty that can give me some momentary relief. That is a really well-established neural network that many patients have. And so the first time that you're trying to establish a new neural network, it's going to feel like laying down new tracks if you've ever gone cross-country skiing, right? You can either follow the well-worn tracks or you can lay down new ones. It's always harder to lay down the new ones. But the idea is that each time you go down those cross-country tracks, it's getting that much more well-formed. And it's the same thing with our neurons. And that's the good news. So when you're taking action, you are helping to form those synaptic connections in a way that no amount of thinking, contemplating, meditating, writing about can ever do. And that leads to results, and results leads to a sense of momentum, a sense of confidence that builds this positive feedback loop. And I've really come to appreciate that there is no substitute for experiential learning. If you just start to notice, you will notice how much you hear others and yourself talk about doing something sometime, someday. there's no substitute for just getting it on the court, doing it, learning from it, failing, correcting, revising, amending, and doing it again. And that brings us to the last one, reflection. This is step four. And in a way, this is another aspect of awareness. It's just on the retrospective end. So whether it's one day, 1 hour, 1 week, 2 weeks, whatever time cycle you're looking at, you can always incorporate a piece of reflection on the back end of action. I mean, trust me, after this talk today, as I was, you know, finalizing my slides in the car at 12:05 p.m., I need to do reflection after to say, okay, how do I get it so that I can finish my slides the night before and be done with it and enjoy the peace that comes the day of the presentation? But the reflection piece is what gives me comfort. The reflection piece is what tells me, like, okay, there's something to learn out of this. And it's changing, quote, failure into this concept of a learning opportunity. How can I grow from this? That is one of the most difficult concepts for my patients to get because we are so outcomes focused, right? But if instead they can start to see, okay, what can I learn from this? Then that can be an incredible learning opportunity. And then the last concept with reflection is there's practice and then there's intentional practice. And I like this word practice because I want patients to just get comfortable with whatever skills they're trying to build, whether it's in the realm of eating or exercise, is they don't have to get it perfect, they're just practicing. So intentional practice, though, is where you're really being thoughtful about it, you're creating a plan, you're reflecting upon it, it's aligned with your values. It's not just doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results. What I like about this cycle is that it's iterative, right? So if people engage in this process of awareness, intention, action, reflection, ultimately, it leads to a new, deeper level of awareness. And from that place of deeper awareness, they can engage in a deeper intention, action, reflection, and so it repeats. And so I invite patients to do this in this endless loop that's not just about one and done, but is continuous. And the final piece of this is sort of a quality of being that I put at the center of this behavioral change framework, and that's self-compassion. Because there's a way of approaching behavioral change where, again, as I mentioned, when will I get to that weight? When will I get off these medications? When will my study be organized? When will I have my talk done prior to, you know, the night before? Where one's sense of self is contingent upon achieving that outcome. And that puts a lot of pressure on people and gives them this sense of conditional acceptance. But there's this quote that, her name's Sophia Bush, she's an actress and singer. She says, you can be both a masterpiece and a work in progress simultaneously. And really sort of inviting patients to embrace that concept of both being a masterpiece as they are right now, this moment, without qualification, as well as an invitation to engage in this continuous loop of improvement, of growth, of falling, getting back up again, I think is a huge act of self-compassion that can actually make any change they experience far more sustainable, far more long-term, and far more aligned with their true deepest priorities and values.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.